I'm Gordon Lanfear with the Real Finds Podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we step into the shoes of America's financial decision makers with Joe Galvin, Chief Research Officer at Visage. We share insights into the minds of America's top CEOs on the topics of workforce, generational divides, the role of AI in the workplace, and the return to office. And most importantly, how corporate America perceives the state of the U.S. economy.
Joe, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Hey, Gordon. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to having a conversation today.
So what got you into work?
Well, like everyone, you reach a point where you realize that you want certain things in life and you have ambitions and et cetera. So I began the world as an athlete. I was actually a college basketball player and played professionally in Spain. But transitioned to sales and got into sales in New York City with Xerox. And that transitioned to Gartner. If you're familiar with Gartner, Gartner is the world's leading IT research and advisory firm. I was an early employee there. And that kind of tracked my career as I built and grew that sales organization. I transitioned and became an analyst. And that's led me to where I am today with Visage, as I'm Chief Research Officer. Visage provides executive coaching and peer advisory services for CEOs of small and mid-sized businesses. And I apply my Gartner-esque business analyst mindset to understanding the issues, challenges, and topics that these CEOs identify as most important to them. Visage has over 44,000 members worldwide. In the United States, we've got more than 13,000 companies. Where we have CEOs as leaders, as members. So I'm in a unique position to be able to really capture the voice of what these CEOs are saying and thinking. We've published our Visage CEO Quarterly Confidence Index since 2003. And that's a series of questions that look at where their sentiments are regarding the economy, backward, forward, revenues, profits, and then investments. But more importantly, we can ask them open-ended questions and data questions. And now, courtesy of AI, we can really blend that together to really capture what their voice is and what they're saying is most important to them. And then we're getting better and better at being able to slice that down into regional, vertical, different attributes of companies to be able to look at that data. And what's powerful about it is when you compare it to fact-based economic data of inflation, unemployment, interest rates, et cetera, this is sentiment data. This is how small and mid-sized business CEOs, which really are the backbone of the U.S. economy, how they are viewing, perceiving, and then interacting and acting with the current environment. And that's across all topics, whether you're talking about the people that work for you, the customers that buy from you, the operations that produce your product and or service, and the numbers behind that. How do leaders interact with that community? And we try to focus on those leaders, those CEOs, right? How do they lead? How do they show up as leaders? What are the best processes, tactics, and strategies for leading? And then what are the issues they lead on, be that talent, customers, operations, or finance? It's a lot of fun. It's really creative. But most importantly, I'm able to really capture what I think is the voice of small and mid-sized business CEOs across the country.
So what are CEOs concerned about these days?
Well, typically, we ask that question, you know, what are your big challenges? And what has been top for the last three quarters has been the uncertainty, just the shifting sands. I call it the Mr. Miyagi approach to tariffs of, you know, tariffs on and tariffs off, and how that really has whipsawed from initially early part of the year when it was talk to where now companies have been writing these checks and paying for these tariffs in manufacturing, and certain it's been passed on in elements in construction, how this is now beginning to flow through. So that uncertainty and the instability that goes with it creates a very challenging environment for CEOs to think about and really plan for where their business is. You know, the big issues is the uncertainty, and that's driving their priorities, political stability. We've seen a shift now as hiring and retention has returned to the number two concern. It had been number three with tariffs and how tariffs are impacting margin. Had been the number three issue, but now we've seen that talent has come back in, and it's interesting because when you look at the workforce, the absolute demand for workers is flat. In fact, we're actually seeing in certain verticals like construction, like manufacturing, where people are, you know, 13% are looking to decrease headcount in the year ahead. Now, is that a result of a slowing economy, or is that a result of gains from some element of productivity, either that through automation or technology? Don't know. We don't have evidence of that yet. But what it shows is that hiring still remains a challenge. And what's driving that challenge is there aren't enough skilled workers at every level. So there are people that are looking for jobs and jobs looking for people, but the skill set has changed. The demands on workers, be they the physical essential workers or be they the knowledge workers, those demands are higher and people are looking, leaders are looking for better people. And as you move into what still seems to be a growing economy, people will still be the fossil fuel of that growth engine. Then, you know, next up is tariffs and what that means about margins. 43% have increased price in the last 6 months. 51% are going to increase prices in the month ahead. And interestingly enough, it's a shift back now to the workforce and the importance of engagement and stability in the workforce. That as we go through these, you know, it's a changing world. The economy is growing, but layoffs are this, interest rates, you know, we can get into that. But it's, do leaders have a stable and engaged workforce? We saw the volatility as we came out of COVID with everybody leaving and everybody changing jobs. Now people are there's less turnover, there's more retention, people are job hugging. And the reality is that it's not just having people in jobs, but having them engaged. And how engagement, which has been a metric that's been around for a long time, is now resurfacing. As you're looking to ensure the people that you have, as people become more expensive, are really performing in ways that you need them to do. And that gets back to the point I made earlier about how the bar for what workers have to do has been raised. So that's top of mind. And that shifts a little bit. The topics remain the same. The points of emphasis shift. But the categories don't really change that much. Or at least they haven't since the first of the year.
Are there particularly strong indicators of unique sore spots within sections of the marketplace that have had particular struggles finding employees, or is it just generally across the board where companies are struggling to find the right employee?
I think it's more across the board. And when you get into the specifics, if you're into construction or you're into manufacturing, the type of advanced manufacturing, yeah, there's a skill set that's required. You know, if you're involved in solar or other, you know, really technical product services, yeah, there's a skill set that's required. You know, we know the trades. You know, the demand for people that are skilled welders, those jobs still exist, will exist, electricians, plumbers. So there's this whole wave of what needs to occur. The demands for the skills go up, but the people that are available to do those, they're just not as readily available. And that's the challenge, is that the bar has risen and what's expected in every role. And not everyone's able to step up to that changing demand.
So I know I have a lot of conversations with CEOs and COOs and HR directors about hybrid work. And that's something I've seen you write a lot about. So what is the C-suite talking about and how do they perceive hybrid work these days?
Well, you need to take, I take hybrid work in the context of the workplace experience, which is prior to COVID, we had a dominant MF95. Now, that's not a new gang or some new operating system. MF95 refers to the Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, analog industrial era workplace, where you were expected to show up at 9 a.m. on Monday, and you could leave at 5 p.m. on Friday or some variation on that theme. Attendance was expected. It was only in unique and specialized cases where you had remote people or people that had special exemptions. COVID changed all that, and that brought this hybrid workplace specifically for knowledge workers into play. So essential workers, if you're in construction, if you're in manufacturing, if you're in healthcare, right? If you're in you know, certain business services, you have to be on site. Those essential workers are going to be on site. And for every organization, there are knowledge workers. When I speak about hybrid, I'm thinking about knowledge workers. So in a construction firm or manufacturing, you're going to have people that have to be on site. That's not going to change. You may be able to reduce the number of them through automation, but you're going to need people that can operate those advanced machines. On the other side of your knowledge workers, finance, HR, accounting, sales, marketing, these are people that work with numbers, words, images, voice, video. They work with knowledge. They can work from anywhere. And what COVID did and the rapid movement to remote is it opened up that possibility and made leaders realize that there is an opportunity here to embrace this. It drives engagement. For those employees who have that flexibility, who can, not everyone can, it drives engagement, but it challenges things like collaboration and innovation. So we went through this rapid learning experience, and now what we find is that the hybrid environment, the remote environment, is relatively stable. We're not seeing a dramatic shift in small and mid-sized businesses. We had over 1,300 CEOs respond to this data that came from early September. There's not a radical shift, and we haven't seen this over a year, of the models. We're seeing a little bit of tuning, maybe going from 3 days in office to 4 days in office or some variant on that theme. But by and large, CEOs aren't swimming upstream against this issue with all these other challenges going on. The status quo has been set in these small and mid-sized businesses. And any change to that is to break the social contract with the workforce that says, okay, we're going back to 5 days in the office. Big companies can dictate it. And we've seen, you know, headlines early in the year, but that they've kind of backed off from that. They've kind of gotten away from that a little bit. Why? Because workers are restless. It's impacting their engagement. We're not seeing the turnover and the transition because the opportunities aren't there. But when you pull this down into the small and mid-sized marketplace, breaking that social contract is not something that CEOs are really looking to do in light of all of the other things they're trying to accomplish. So we see this model of hybrid remote on-site as relatively stable. And what we're also seeing is that leaders, specifically those managers who work directly with the workers, are becoming better at how to manage that hybrid environment. And hybrid workers, I think, recognize the value and how much they value flexibility, that flexibility is one of the new requirements for the workplace. And as a leader, you can choose to be fully on site or fully remote and every variant on that spectrum. And you will attract people to your organization who want to work in that model. Consequently, that decision that you make as a leader today, this is our model. Well, that's the model that's going to attract or repel people to your organization. So if you believe you want 5 day a week in the office, MF95 headset, well, that's who's going to want to work there. And there's some people that want to work like that, and that's fine. Other people don't. So it's kind of like creating your product in the marketplace to attract and retain workers. Because again, no matter how far we go down the path of AI in the workplace 2030, right, it will still require humans to operate those advanced agents and AI systems that will, you know, revolutionize business as we look far over the horizon.
Is there a big generational divide on how folks are perceiving it and kind of how our C-suite is perceiving the generations within the office?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've got five generations in the workplace. You know, you've got boomers at the end of their career and the new folks just coming into the career. And the boomers who grew up in an analog world and those, you know, Zs that are coming to the workforce that know nothing but digital, there's different ways of viewing and seeing and interpreting the world. How they go about, how they work together, how they collaborate, how they get things done, and being able to manage that generational, how those generations interact and intersect is really important. Having said this, the movement towards a future state office is going to pull those Gen Zs faster to it, replacing the boomers who will drop out and no longer want to keep up with what that means. So yeah, when you talk about hybrid, I think when you bring it back to hybrid anyway, the Zs who have entered the workforce have always had it. They don't know any different. But old guys like me who grew up in that MF95, you will be here, which existed, you know, even 10 years ago. It's an amazing revolution. I've worked from home since 2012. And I could never imagine going to an office. But I think for younger workers, that full virtual or full remote environment is not the best for them. They miss out on the building of relationships. I go to games with guys that I worked with in the 80s back in Xerox. We built these networks. My period of time at Gartner built these networks of people because you're seeing them. You're physically engaged with them. So I think that it's important. And I would counsel any Gen Zs or anyone who's young in the workforce, go to the office, be in the office. Be in the office when your boss is in the office. Be in the office when the smart people are in the office. Interact with them, build those relationships. There'll be time, you know, later on in your career to move out and move on into a more, you know, distant horizon. But right here, right now, it is about learning from others and building those relationships. That still matters, and I believe that will always matter.
Yeah, one of the most productive things I've ever had in work, be it, you know, in law or in sales or in real estate or investing, is just getting a cup of coffee with some of the folks that really know what they're doing around the office. That's been incredibly productive. One of the things that we hear a lot of people talking about is just productivity in general and how we measure it. I think generally we really still don't have it all figured out in terms of that. I'm not sure we ever will, but how do CEOs see productivity and measuring productive workspaces?
But you know, you mentioned productivity is kind of like the, you know, the old British saying, how long is a piece of string? Well, it depends, right? In widget type environments, just to use a simple phrase, when I know it costs X to produce Y, my inputs, when you have hard numbers and data, that's one way to measure productivity. When you apply that to people, it becomes more difficult, right? I've got 200 people producing, you know, $10 million, $10 or $100 million, right? Can I get 200 people to produce $150 million? So, and then how do you do that? Now you're into the value of what a human does and how do you measure and quantify that? And that's really hard to do. You can measure time, which is the, you know, the MF95 digital, you know, analog world. We knew that we wanted you to be there from 9 to 5, and we expected you to work hard during that period of time. Well, that's all changed now with people working 24/7 and being flexible and working where they can and where they want. So it becomes much more difficult to measure productivity. I would suggest it's kind of like culture. You can't see it, but you can feel it when you walk into an organization. It's kind of like gravity. You can't see gravity, but you feel it with every step you take. You can sense productivity and productivity increases based on how people engage and how they function. And I think we're seeing, you know, increases in productivity have been driven by technology, but on an individual basis, AI, specifically generative AI, is really driving leaps and bounds of individual productivity as people figure out real quickly how they can apply this tool to what they do. And this now gets into the challenge for leaders, because if I now can turn a 4-hour knowledge task into a 30-minute knowledge task, what do I do with that 3.5 hours? Because I'm remote, am I going to go to another Pilates class? You know, am I going to go mow the yard, right? Or am I now going to take that 3.5 hours and reinvest that time into digging deeper, creating, you know, that's the tension that's slowly building as we see the productivity of individuals. I go on a tangent on this if you want to go deeper on this, but it's interesting how this tension of workers figuring out how to do things a little bit better is already being co-opted by leaders who are now saying, we're not going to replace someone who leaves until you can show me that AI can't do it. Or if somebody does leave, we're not going to replace them, and you're all just going to figure out how to handle that workload more productively because you can. So it's creating this tension, and again, this is in the knowledge worker space, as folks want to do more, and then in some cases are penalized for that.
So one of the big penalties we've talked about on the podcast is the meeting tax, and I know you've written a volume on this. They're definitely effective work cultures, but the meeting-heavy office place is probably not one of them. I'm curious, can you elaborate on that and kind of where we're seeing the blend of working together versus just, you know, working to fill up the day?
Yeah. I think I want to go back to my metaphor of the Monday, Friday, 9 to 5 office, right? In that environment, people who were working, showing up, maybe they were disengaged, but people would fill their calendars with meetings to create the illusion of activity and to create the illusion of busyness to fill their calendars because they had to be there all day anyway. Right? And it's better to sit in a meeting and nod your head than to actually try to do something. So these were the quiet quitters was the phrase that was bopping around in the employment space for a while, right? These are the quiet quitters, right? Well, they thrived in the early days of remote work, right? Because they could just quit all the way and just show up with a shirt on and gym shorts and go through the motions. The meeting heavy culture, I think, was driven as a result of the requirement to fill your time and to create the illusion or to be busy, right? But busy is not being productive. Being busy is being busy. So as you pull this apart, it's why are meetings being held? What's the goal and objectives? And how does that fit into what we're trying to accomplish versus a more nimble, more digitally driven, more, you know, the ability to interact in groups quickly in a virtual world? I think that's where you're seeing the movement towards. It's not so much about filling conference rooms as it is creating environments where people can collaborate and share, you know, especially in these environments where you're in for 3 days, in the office 3 days. Those are the days you want to have meetings. Those are the days that you want people to be in those environments where you can collaborate, where you can innovate, you know, get to know people, build those relationships. So then you can go off and do your individual work in a better area, which is usually in the remote environment.
So, you know, how do we keep culture if it's not, and we're in a remote world or a hybrid world, or even just a 5 days a week office world, without forcing people to gather together? Is it pizza parties? Is it like what's the methodology behind trying to retain a good workforce culture?
Well, culture is, as I said, it's something, whether you consciously do it or not, there's a culture in every organization. You put a group of humans together for a half-day seminar and a culture will emerge. That's just how humans function. So we speak about creating a conscious culture, right? A conscious culture means that everyone in the organization understands, you know, what are the values? What's the mission? What's the purpose? What are we tied to? Workers fundamentally need to feel like the work that they do is valued and respected and contributes to something above and beyond themselves, that they're connected to what the organization is doing. So when you think about culture, one, it's driven from the leader in creating the culture, establishing the standards, and living and breathing that culture down through the organization. But as a worker, I experience culture directly through my manager or my boss. So the apostles of the culture, you know, the people that are going out, the evangelicals of the culture, have to be your managers. If my manager embraces the culture, if my manager talks about the values, if my manager connects what we do to the greater part, I will feel connected to that. And then the human stuff that managers have to do. If my manager says, you know, that CEO, he's crazy, or, you know, we're not doing that, or I'm going to build my own little fiefdom culture over here, that's when cultures get torn apart. And this gets amplified in the hybrid environment. Because in the physical environment, it's much easier to see and observe and muscle that around. In the hybrid environment, where it effectively happens, you know, in a digital sphere, it's much harder to see where that occurs. So when you think about building and creating culture, it starts with the leader being authentic, creating clear shared goals and objectives, and being transparent. That builds trust. And trust is something that takes months and years to build and seconds to destroy. But trust is imperative to a culture, right? Then having that culture come in and live and breathe through the manager who's working with the workers makes them feel that they're part of something bigger than themselves. A key element to engagement, and engagement is really the data point about employees' willingness to give discretionary effort to improve their performance and therefore the performance of the business.
So, you know, building culture over the years is great. And I work with a lot of businesses that have wonderful cultures, and some that are, you know, improving their cultures. One of the ways that we can improve culture is not sit there day to day and help these businesses try to improve their culture on an hourly basis, but to help them find spaces that work. I know you've written about the office of the future and kind of some trends in design and office layout and office structure. I'm curious if you could kind of touch on kind of things like designing an office for the future, because that's something that's not only near and dear to my heart, but also near and dear to what I do on a daily basis.
Well, I think to answer that question, first you have to talk about what the office of the future is going to look like. And I think there's two letters that will define that, and those letters are A and I. Right? The workplace of I call it workplace 2030, which is when we will move beyond the initial wave, not wave as in like a wave on a beach, but like a pulse wave of energy, of individual productivity that AI is going to drive. Right? The second pulse or wave will be at the work group level, where now we look at automating. How do you and I work together, and how can we find those points of friction, those points of stress, or those points of opportunity where what we do in our little work group can be better? And then the third, bigger, more transformative and longer term pulse is that organizational transformation. When you rebuild the business around an AI world, where Gen AI that you see today is a biplane compared to the prop plane we'll see in 5 years and the turbojet we'll see in 10. That's the progression we're going to see with this. So you take that in context of what that means to essential workers. Well, they will be plugging into a smarter, more virtual, artificially intelligent, but you'll be dealing with avatars and bots when you come back in to check on something, whether you're in the field or on the line, you'll be dealing with much more advanced systems. For the knowledge workers, it will be the digitally engaged today. Those people that today are really leveraging and pushing the envelope on what they can do with AI, they'll be the operators of these advanced agents and systems. they will not be fully automated, right? They will require human intervention. So you will still have the requirements of the people operating those systems to be connected at a human level with the people that are driving strategy. So the operators of those systems have to be connected to the humans that are building and developing those strategies as that flow of information goes in two directions. So the leaders now have deeper insights. They've got, you know, more specific, precise, up to the nanosecond access to information through these AI agents and bots to make decisions. But then those decisions have to flow through, and the operators of these systems, be they customer systems, be they marketing systems, sales system, inventory. Think of all the different systems out there and how that layer of automation, the autonomous nature of what the agents can do, and now who are going to be the workers that are going to be operating those systems. You'll still need HR. You'll still need people, but they will be doing radically different things than what they're doing today. I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Bloomington, a child of State Farm Insurance. My dad worked at State Farm Insurance. And I can remember going to see his office in the 60s, and it was just a massive floor of people doing data entry into ledgers with typewriters, physical ledgers. Fast forward that to one guy in a corner with a computer, fast forward to an AI world where it just poof, it happens. That's the transfer. Now, all those people on those typewriters, they found other things to do. The people operating today's systems, they will find other things. Not all of them will matriculate and become those operators of these next gen systems. But there'll be places and jobs and opportunities for them. It's not like they will be going jobless. But that transformation is going to occur. So now you play that back to what does that workspace need to look like? It needs to be entirely human because everything that they do will be entirely, you know, artificially automated, right? It will need to create environments for human interactions because you'll still want to have the relationships and the trust between leaders and managers and workers. You'll want to have creative and collaborative spaces. As this end state suggests, there'll be we finally got there and now we've AI transformed. No, it's going to always evolve and change. So the need for innovation and the need for constant evolution of your processes and tools and systems, you'll need environments where that can happen. And again, what you want to have happen is the things that can uniquely happen with humans, which is trust, relationships, innovation, creativeness, and let the machines do the repetitive and the automation.
So one of the things that I don't want to get too repetitive on is the return to office and hybrid. Yeah. But I'd love to dive back to kind of the start of the episode where we talked a lot about kind of how CEOs are perceiving things.
Right.
Where is the CEO confidence generally right now? And, you know, for anybody in this episode coming out, we're filming right now in the middle of October. This will probably go out probably near the end of October. Where's CEO confidence in terms of not just hiring, but also just the economy in general, and kind of how are they perceiving things going forward in terms of things like investment, leasing, and kind of the process of deploying capital?
Yeah. The Vicious CEO Confidence Index has been running since 2003. I've been driving it since 2016 when I joined the organization as chief research officer. It's really interesting because, one, we get the voice of CEOs. We had over 1,300 CEOs respond. Now, 1,300 is a massive number of responses for any type of survey. But what's also valuable is that we know they're all CEOs because they're all our members. So it's not just the number, it's the purity of the number. The confidence index remains at historical lows. If you compare the 2010s, I call that the rising tide decade. 2010 is the end of the Great Recession up to 2020 and COVID. Steady, stable. There were some ups and downs. There was some craziness, but by and large, steady, stable growth, right? COVID happens, and now we're in this post-COVID world. And the data compared to that rising tide is really negative. Our confidence index rose slightly to 81.9. up 4 points, but that's not much. It's been bouncing in this range around the mid-80s, low 80s, since we stabilized out of COVID. What's holding it back is economic expectations. CEOs maintain a negative perception of the economy. Only 20% nationally, looking back, thought the economy had improved in the last year. Only 32% looking ahead think it will improve. So there's real negativity around the economy. When we ask about the prospects for their business, so I ask you about the economy, you're going to tell me what you think about it, right? And that can be driven by A, what's happening in your business, B, what news source you choose to listen to, right? When we talk about profits and revenue, 60%, so 60% still plan or expect increase in revenue in the year ahead. And that's up a little bit, but it's still down from the norms of the rising tide. 48% think they'll see rising profits. So there are areas and packets where places where people are doing really well, but there's not a lot of energy behind this. And then the third area we look at is expansion. And that is that we see 34% are going to increase their investments in the year ahead, and 48% are going to increase their headcount. Now, again, those numbers are closer to what the norms have been, but they're still back. I think I'll capture and summarize the sentiment as saying that, you know, CEOs are on the fence. You know, we have that time old statement of time will tell. Well, you look at this and the economy is booming. You look at that and the economy is going to cave. So are we poised? Are we poised for growth, or are we going to pivot to a recession? We don't know. And that's kind of where CEOs are sitting right now. And we're moving into the strategic planning season. So now you're beginning to look at it and say, hey, what is 2026 going to look like? I've closed the third quarter. I can look out at my forecast going to tell me where I'm going to end in the fourth quarter. Now I'm looking out to 26. I got a plan for what's tariffs are going to do. You know, is this inflation really going to spike? Is unemployment going to spike? Are interest rates going to go down? Are they going to go blah, blah, blah? How do you do that in this world of turmoil? And that's why this data is so important. We'll learn more when we do this survey again in December. We do this four times a year, and we'll get a sense for their sentiment. But right now, I would say they're waiting to know, do I put up more sail and let the wind blow me, or do I roll my sails up and ride this out?
Yeah. So let's ride out a little bit on this podcast to our final four. It's a great opportunity to wrap things up, learn a little bit more about you, learn a little bit more about where things are going in the world, and maybe make some connections. So the first thing that we always love to talk about is dive into where we think our experts' point of expertise is going. And your work expert, where do you think work is going to be 10 years from now?
Work will be radically different. Work will be radically different as we will be living in the AI world. And we've heard about AI for years and years and years, but when Gen AI hit the mainstream like a browser, it explodes. So I think in 10 years, you're going to see a radically different workforce. It's really challenging is that I look at my grandkids or I look at our friends' kids coming out of college. It's like, how do you prepare for that? Well, we live in an age of accelerated disruption, which means the disruptions are happening faster and quicker. So when you look ahead, even 5 years, I talk about Workplace 2030, it's going to be radically different. And it's going to require folks that are digitally engaged, they're motivated, and the opportunities will be there, but they will change. It will not be the stable, more stable, traditional MF95 workplace.
So one thing that we have, and we can't give the next generation stability on this podcast, but what we can potentially give them is a little bit of advice. And I'm curious, if you were giving advice to a young Joe, what would it be?
Technology. Understand how it works. Understand how to leverage it. You do not have to be a technologist, but you need to be knowledgeable enough to create, design the systems that will power businesses, because that will continue to evolve as technology evolves, but also customers will evolve. And it's the ability to translate customers' evolving needs into whatever it is that your product or service is. That will be the friction point where humans will always be needed. Or go to trade school, get a good trade career, and build a nice electrical business, because I know I need somebody to come out here and fix about a half a dozen things in my house.
I think one of the biggest changes in my lifetime has been the increasing relevance of the trades. I know when I started off working in real estate in, you know, the late 2000s, the world of trades was vastly different than it is today. And there, I have so much respect for anybody who can actually do something real in the world physically with their hands. And the profitability that you see, and we see balance sheets all the time of plumbers, electricians that we work with. I don't think enough white collar workers realize that how profitable some of the trades are.
I had no appreciation for the sophistication and the quality of these businesses, whether it's individuals or groups of companies doing this space. I spent most of my career in tech, so you're talking to tech people, and it's like that's a different world over here. And at Vistage, 23% of our member companies are construction, 22% are manufacturing, and just crazy cool companies doing amazing stuff that require really specialized skills. And that comes back to where we started about, leaders are looking for qualified workers that can bring these advanced skills to the advancing systems that they want to deploy.
So one of the ways that we like to learn these advanced skills is through media, and that could be books, podcasts. So if someone's out there listening to the podcast right now, what would be the next book or podcast or media that you would suggest for them to pick up?
I follow Peter Zohan, and he wrote the book about all the changes coming. I find his content is interesting and somewhat objective. That would be a place to go. I also follow technology closely. So anything that's speaking credibly about the disruption of AI in the workplace, and more importantly to the workforce, I think is going to be interesting. And so that's where I'm focused. I spend most of my reading into things that are happening now versus thinking over the horizon. I spend a lot of my time digging into what our CEOs are thinking about, but I try to look over the horizon for stuff like that, because the shifts are going to be profound, and it's this broader notion of accelerated disruption, that change is coming quicker than it's come before.
So speaking of disruption, the whole reason for the podcast is to kind of disrupt our train of thought and go and look at a new part of the market or listen to a new voice. And I'm curious, who's the next voice we should have on our podcast?
I would suggest a gentleman named Mark Emmer. Mark Emmer is a Vistage member and a Vistage speaker out in California. He is in the process of publishing a series on trends. So he looks at trends across the workplace, across technology, across society. He's going to publish one. Actually, by the time this podcast comes out, he will have published all four. Mark takes a very pragmatic look and summarizes very succinctly what the driving factors are in a variety of categories. It's his trend series. So Mark Emmer, very, very smart man.
We'll reach out to Mark, but if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
Our nomenclature is joe.galvin@vistage.com, or just go to vistage.com, go to the research center. You'll find all of our content, everything we publish, our confidence index, our research reports are available for everyone. We want to help all small and mid-sized business CEOs by drawing attention to the issues, topics, and decisions that our community tells us are most important. We want to help CEOs become better leaders, make better decisions, get better results. Vistage is a pretty cool place.
Joe, thank you so much. We really appreciate having you on the podcast. We got to have you on in the future.
Thanks again to Joe. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you hear podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.